I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Milwaukee Ballet, such an extraordinarily wonderful ballet led by an extraordinarily wonderfully creative and talented artistic director, has announced their 2016 and 2017 season. We'll talk about that during the course of the hour with Michael Pink, who is the longest serving artistic director in Milwaukee Ballet history. He's been here. I can't believe it's been this long. We've been talking about the passage of time. He was last with us 2 years ago. It seems like nearly a year ago, and he has been with the ballet since 2002, which is pretty remarkable. His production of Peter Pan was a major landmark in the history of the company, broadcast nationally by PBS in the spring of 2014. His productions of Dracula, Esmeralda, Swan Lake, Giselle, The Sleeping Beauty, Cinderella, Romeo and Juliet, La Boheme, Don Quixote, and Mirror, Mirror have been hailed as classical ballet for the 21st century. He is an international choreographer and teacher, trained as a classical dancer at the Royal Ballet, joining the English National Ballet in 75, danced many leading roles, and we're delighted to have him with us again. And he's here after 2 years. And we'll be welcoming phone calls. Some of you may have seen some productions of the ballet, or you'd like to be in the ballet. I want to start with his really interesting life, because it's worth hearing, and you know what it takes to be a dancer and what it's like. Is it a terribly dictatorial thing? Usually for most ballets, you're told what to do. Does he have a different vision for how he choreographs and what he gets from dancers, and how you make it in the ballet world, how long the career is, you know, all of that. So we're going to talk about all of it with Michael Pink. Our phone number for you to join the conversation with him is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter is at K Dunn Show. And Michael, I can't believe it's been 2 years since I talked to you.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so glad you're back.
Well, I'm glad I'm back. I was beginning to think I might have done something wrong.
You did absolutely nothing wrong.
Okay,
time passed, and we didn't forget about you, though, because
okay.
Here you are again now. I was reading this old Milwaukee Magazine piece a couple of years ago, which is really interesting. It's long piece about you.
Fun.
So let's go back to the thing where your mother took you to a ballet performance, and you said Mummy wanted to be a ballet dancer, and she talked about how difficult it was, and you thought when you were how old, you were just a kid, well, maybe I should learn to do some of that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I was probably 8 years old, and the key for me was that from the very beginning of time, my life, I don't have any memories of ever wanting to do anything other than be in the theater. It was non-specific. I wouldn't have been able to say I'm going to do this or do that, but I do know that my love was singing. My first love was singing.
Was it really singing?
Absolutely. And both my parents were members of the Amateur Operatic and Dramatic Society, which is a big deal in England. It's this whole fellowship of people around the country who put on the great musicals, Carousel, Showboat, all of those wonderful musicals. And they're all amateurs. And they come together and they do a show and everybody stitches the costumes and makes the scenery. And my dad used to do all the publicity. My mother was wardrobe. My elder brother did the treasurer and the photographer for the organization for a while. My younger brother was the lighting designer for a while. So it's one of those big family affairs. And I always knew then from that experience that I loved entertaining and I wanted to do that. And hence it led to me just going along to the performance of dance and saying, so this looks really interesting. How difficult, Mum? And she said, really, really difficult. And I said, well, I should probably have a go at that. So it was more about collecting experiences than anything else. And then I got stuck. Hmm. I got stuck somehow. But then, you know, in the 60s, when you're, you know, a young man dancing, it's the sort of Billy Elliot story that
you were bullied.
Yeah, I was bullied, really badly bullied. Absolutely. And I think, again, coming from a very, you know, strong working class background, you didn't wince and moan about things. If you got a beating, you just shut up and get on with it, which is not exactly, I wouldn't advocate that anybody does that. But it's working class background. It's a sign of weakness if you show your emotional weakness. And so actually, it was a memorable day. I remember my mum sort of just catching me mid taking off a shirt and all these bruises on my body. and just kind of questioning what had been going on. And I said, it's fine, don't worry, Mum, it's fine, I can get through all this. And so they didn't, and they went to speak to the school authorities, and they said, it's very simple, we'll just move him to a better school where they're far more appreciative of liberal arts. And I did, but I wasn't there that long, because then I moved on to the Royal Ballet School in London, which was a whole different ballgame.
Does the bullying stop for young dancers, male dancers?
No, because ignorance will prevail, and it's always a lack of understanding of what it takes to be a dancer. And still, I think things obviously are huge, have improved enormously in terms of when we talk about male dancers, we don't immediately jump to the assumption that one must be gay and one must be effeminate, because we've seen, as dance generally has moved on, we see all these So You Think You Can Dance programs, things on television that have in some way really helped people to understand you need to be very physically fit,
you need to be
strong. So we see all our celebrities trying to be dancers, and you can see the blood, sweat and tears that goes into it. So I think it's elevated the situation. But again, it depends where you are. I mean, in what part of the country? We know that wherever you are coming from, hailing from in your country, your level of exposure to art in general may be limited. People that live in this wonderful city have the opportunity to experience a wide variety of art. They're, 10, 15 miles out in the country, people probably just don't come downtown. Mm-hmm. They don't experience. So what is their level of exposure to it? So their understanding of what it takes to be a dancer or any other artist is probably very limited.
Well, let's talk about what it takes. Your mother's saying it's very, very hard. How was it very hard?
It's very hard because you're trying to do it like a gymnast. You're trying to do things to your body that God did not intend it to do. We have this magic thing called turning out. It's different from just turning up to work. When you turn up to work, you have to turn out. And the turnout is this physical, strange thing where you're going to stand and you're going to place your feet in a position, which means you've got to rotate your entire leg from your hip sockets into this position. And then once you've got that, you've got to hold on to it. And then, hey, presto, you've got to suddenly rise up on your toes. And then you've got to jump in the air and land in this position. It becomes, you look at it and you go, this is pretty insane.
Yeah.
Pretty insane. But it's the aesthetic of classical ballet, and it's what makes classical ballet so beautiful is that we refer to it as line, like an artist would refer to the line of a drawing or a sculpture. You look at it and you go, that looks perfectly proportioned. That looks beautiful. So that's what we strive for. And it's what really defines whether you can or cannot become a classical dancer, because if you don't have the physical attributes to begin with, then it becomes increasingly harder to attain any level of competency as a classical dancer. The world is a far more forgiving place when it comes to looking at the aesthetic of classical dancers, because our choreographers have moved on to create this whole new vocabulary of movement and styles. We're pushing and challenging our bodies all the time. So we are far more forgiving about a dancer now. If you look at the dancers in my company, I have the most amazing dancers. But if you were to say now, do they all fit the mold of being perfect classical dancers in terms of the proportions? They have the right ratio of leg to arm length to back to head, their feet are in a particular way.
Right.
No, the answer is no, they don't. But what they do have is an incredible artistry and ability to be all things when it comes to the kind of productions that we produce. So it's hard in that respect. The hours of work you have to put in. So I went to the Royal Ballet School when I was, I was 11. I went to the Royal Ballet School, and that's full-time training. That's vocational training. I was in a boarding environment, boarding school environment. And so every day I had to do class, and then I had to do my academic studies. And then at the weekend we would do class. And I wasn't allowed to play football, the English version. I wasn't allowed to do dangerous sports where I might break something, because now you're a commodity that the Royal Ballet had decided we're going to train you, we're going to make you into a dancer, and ideally you will become a dancer in our company. So we're creating a product that we'll be investing in.
Did you like it?
Hated it.
Did you?
Hated it. And I once told my mum that, and I realized afterwards how insensitive that must have been, because, as I said, we came from a working class background. I think my parents had each have three jobs just for to pay for me to be there.
Oh, my goodness.
And in the early days, it was nowhere near as expensive as it is now. And I gained scholarships and grants to do it. But there was something about the school that I've often thought back to and thinking, oh, my God, it started from a position position where it wanted to break you down and then rebuild you in a way that they felt is something that they wanted. And I felt that was like tearing out the heart and soul of a person. And I guess I've always been fairly sort of strong-willed and strong-minded, so I rebelled against that from the beginning. So it wasn't uncommon for my mum to get letters saying, we're sending him home. He's impossible. We're doing this with him, which I'm not proud about to this day. But secretly, of course, I'm thinking that's who I was back mm-hmm. then, and it's perhaps has made me who the man I am today.
You're a bit of a rebel.
I don't mind being a bit of a rebel. Yeah, as long as I have a cause, I can be a rebel. And so it was very interesting for me. Of course, the irony was when the time came to elect a head boy for the school or a head girl for the school, they chose me. And my mum came to the studio for my graduation day and somebody asked me to do something. One of the teachers asked me to do something and they were very courteous and they said, please, Michael, would you sort this out? And she went, you say please to him? What are you doing? And they said, we learnt very early on if we didn't say please, he couldn't hear us.
That's great.
Again, I must have been a nightmare, but...
So when you talked about this, taking a human being and sort of molding him or her into what the vision of a classical dancer should be, and I'm wondering, because you don't really operate that way, and I'm wondering if that is still the vision of directors of ballets all over the world, that you take this form and you mold it to what a classical dancer, ballet dancer should be. Mm. You do something different. Is that the norm, and what do you do that's different?
I think in a lot of the major teaching institutions, I think that still is the case. You're looking, again, if you're looking for kids to go into the New York City Ballet, and they're going to have the pick of the best, so they really can be selective in terms of what is the starting material, what are the bodies I'm going to be working with, so they can do that, and they can really just then build on that. I think for the majority of companies and schools, that's something that is just not possible. So for me, it's very much about looking at the individuals, because it's about what's in their mind and their dedication and their determination to succeed as much as it is about what the physical attributes are. We can always continue to work. We have a very strong training regime at the Milwaukee Ballet. From the very beginning, I made it clear to the dancers, I don't regard their daily training as what we call a warm-up. It's not like just running around the field and getting warm and then playing the game. The game starts when you start every morning at 9:30 and we do 1.5 hours of training, in which we cover pretty much the entire vocabulary of dance or the basis of dance, so we can keep ourselves safe and strong and we can continue to grow, because it's a profession where you never really finish learning what you need to do. And as you get wiser and older and you understand your body more and you know how to do things, then age starts to creep in. And
yes.
I say age, but a dancer's age, where the body is rebelling a little bit mm-hmm. against this. You're carrying.
When does that happen, Michael?
It happens at different ages, but once you really get to the end of your 20s, you have to seriously start thinking about how to preserve your body and how to do well. And again, coming back to the demands that we place on our bodies in this day and age with some of the choreographic vocabulary of anybody that came to see our recent production last weekend, will see there was extreme movement. There was rapid, fast, extreme movement. Any one of those movements pushes the body to an extreme, to an end, that borders on being dangerous sometimes. So injury is just a moment away.
Right.
And as with so many things, it's usually nothing heroic that happens. It's just a simple thing.
Yeah.
You know, there's times you get out of bed, you turn around a little bit too quickly and you go, oh, that's me for the day. Dancers are exactly the same. It's the little things. So we continually strive to train them to keep them safe, healthy, and happy, and mentally as well, to be able to keep them going. It's really one of the only art forms that every day, the day begins the same for everybody. It doesn't matter whether you were the star the evening before. When you come back to the studio the following morning, everybody stands at the ballet bar, everybody does the same things. We come back. It's a great leveler.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great leveler,
right,
which is good for building community, good for building
right.
teamwork. So it was hard. It was very hard. And I trained for 6 years at the Royal Ballet School, which was pretty intense. And the Royal Ballet actually gave me a contract. There's a lot of story in there about how did I get interested in choreography, and that happened whilst I was there. So that really took my interest as well. But they gave me a contract for the Royal Ballet, and literally a week or so before I was due to start, they came out and said, oh, we've had a change of heart. We're not going to do that. We're not going to give you the contract. And I was upset, and my dad was upset.
I imagine, sure.
But in hindsight, of course, It was probably the best thing that ever happened to me. And it wasn't anything to do with who I was or what had gone before. There'd been a change of management, and they just, like so many changes of management, they didn't want to make too many changes and so forth. And that liberated me. I went on to join London Festival Ballet, and I spent 10 years with a phenomenal company, traveling the world. I worked with Rudolf Nureyev, who became a close friend. He was such an influence on me as an artist, and really saw something in me and helped me grow. So I met and worked with the most fantastic people that had I not, you know, had I gone to the Royal Ballet, that would not have happened. I would have been waiting in line for my opportunity, because again, institutions like to say, as any institution, you need to give years of service and then we'll think about promotion and then this will happen.
Right.
And it was very much like that. It's not like that now, but it really was. So you would.
So how did Milwaukee happen?
Milwaukee was just, I was actually, as a choreographer on stage, I was working in Oslo, and a friend of mine whose family lives here, he'd just come back to Oslo, and he said, hey, the company just had an unfortunate situation where both their executive and their artistic director announced they were leaving. This is a really interesting company. You should look into it. At the same time, I got a phone call from a friend from London who knew the company here and said also, you should check it out. So I wrote, a two-line email to a contact person who was Katie Heil, who is a great supporter of the ballet and lifelong friend now, just wonderful person, and said, I understand you've had an unfortunate situation of losing both of your leaders. Send me some information. And she did. And I think I was over within a couple of months. We set up an interview. I spent 4 days here. Discussed, met with everybody, met with Simon Dow, who was the outgoing director. And from the moment I came from the airport here, I went, there's something about this place that's appealing. And I think I told you before, it was a lot to do with the architecture, the Germanic architecture here, the lake for sure.
Yes.
It suddenly all felt like it wasn't America. There was something about this place. And I told my wife. And, of course, she didn't get to come over and see it before I'd agreed to do the job. And but she herself, when she came from the airport, she had the same impact. She went, this could be home. Interesting, Kathleen, was throughout my life, I've never said, oh, I'm going to do this job for 2 years or 3 years, or I'm going to do this job for a period of time. I've always just entered into something thinking we're going to fully immerse ourselves. We'll see what happens, and then we'll see what happens next. And cross those bridges when it came to it. So if you'd have told me back then I was going to be here this long, I would have probably thought you were insane. So, and talk about time travel. It's gone so fast. It's just incredible. And there's so much to do here and so much to try and achieve for all of our arts, for our city. It's now extraordinary to think that wasn't here when I arrived here. That wasn't here. Oh my God, look what that. Yeah. And the whole city is evolving, which is wonderful to see what's going on building wise. Yes, the ballet still needs a new home. I'd love to take care of that and make sure we put the company in a place where we can be appreciated more and visible and we can do more for the community. I'm very committed to the entire community. I think I've never thought of the ballet as a little small entity that sits on the side. If we, you know, if the community prospers, in particular the arts community, and if I can help in any way, that also makes my job so much more enjoyable. We can all rise together. So I'm very committed to continuing to develop things. I'd love to see a complete cultural plan for this city where we can try and raise our city awareness. I want to see, you know, greater funding per capita for the arts in our community, given we already have such incredible arts.
Yes, we do. Yes,
awareness,
we do.
Awareness, education, bringing people to understand this, seeing all these apartments being built downtown and the Northwestern Mutual Tower. If they're going to employ 500 new people to come up with 500 people are going to come into the city, then the arts are here for them. We need to be able to elevate that. We've got all the messages for the city to grow, and we just need to get on with it. It's the kind of place, it's like England. People like to talk about things a lot, and they talk, and they pontificate, and they think, and then they and then they drink another glass of whiskey, and then they talk a bit more about it, and then they smoke a cigar. And that's part of growing up in England. You expect that. It's like joining the Royal Ballet. You join the long line, and you wait, and you wait, and you wait, and if you keep your head down and do what you're supposed to do, chances are you might succeed. Well, you know what? Maybe it's because I'm getting old, but I'm getting more impatient.
You want things to happen. Well, let's talk more about ballet in just a moment. And about the last time you were here, and I think about this every time I see the ballet in Milwaukee, that you've put all this incredible work into it, and you don't do many performances. And I think, oh, my gosh, how that shouldn't be. It just shouldn't be. So building the ballet in Milwaukee. We'll also talk about next year's season, which has been announced. We'd love to hear from some of you who have been to some of this year's season. We'll talk about Michael Pink's philosophy of working with dancers, about the story, about the kind of ballet that he's doing. I love this when they have the choreographers who come, who create ballet. They pick three. I always go to that every year, and it's
the Genesis program.
Yeah, love that. So here's the phone number if you'd like to join us. The number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Michael Pink is our guest. Since 2002, he has been the Milwaukee Ballet Company's artistic director and has, as has been written about him, transformed the institution into a company that reflects a relatively unique approach to the art form. And we'll talk about that approach as we carry on. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Michael Pink is our guest now, the artistic director of the Milwaukee Ballet. And if you want to join us, he's great to listen to. But if you have any questions about the ballet, we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Let's talk about your approach to the ballet, Michael. It's been written that you have a relatively unique approach, that you see it as a way of telling stories, a multi-sensory way of telling stories. What sets you apart from other artistic directors?
I would think it's probably just the way in which I approach telling a story in nonverbal theatre, so with no words. I try and approach it not from thinking as is traditional in classical ballet and a lot of companies still today, which is think about the dance steps. Let's think about the dance. Let's think about the dance opportunities. So how many dances can we get into it? And when you look back at 19th century classical ballet, The Great Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauties, the original Nutcrackers, you look at them and you realize there are moments, long moments, when there's just dancing, when it's a character dance, or whether it's little swans and big swans, and whether it's fairies and flowers,
right,
and whether it's guys jumping around. So it was geared to as a showcase for this new art form of that time. And so I think that's the traditional 19th century traditional way of doing it. Now, when you see a lot of classical ballets that tell stories, they still somewhat observe that rule. And largely, a lot of time is because they're using classical music that exists, or they're taking one of those famous scores and they're just reinterpreting it. I always knew that for me the story would be the most important thing. So if I could tell the story and keep a sense of pace and interest for our audience, because I'm realizing that it's really a small percentage of our audience that is familiar with classical ballet and the format of classical ballet. So if we wanted to grow the art form and really make it relevant to today's audience, we were going to have to look at what are the things that people are looking for. And they're really very simple. It's making sure that the story makes sense, that we don't have long moments that are unexplained and just say, it's just dance, don't worry. It's just move on. The story's coming back in a minute. It's like having long commercial breaks. The music, wherever possible, should be commissioned to support the story, so it really would be like listening to a very detailed film score, and that the sets and the costumes and the lighting should by themselves be so engaging and entertaining that the audience could really escape into whichever world we wanted to do. Now, anybody who's seen any of our productions, whether it's a restaging of Swan Lake or Giselle, which are major classical ballets, or whether it's Mirror Mirror or Peter Pan or La Boheme, people should come out feeling that the entire experience was just 360 degrees. It was engrossing, and I've heard it many times where people really have just pinpointed and said the lighting, oh my gosh, it was amazing, and that music, and so all of your senses are being stimulated,
right.
And I think that's certainly a way to to draw people into the world. But selfishly for me, it allows me to feel that I'm telling a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And there are layers and layers of thought process and story and backstory, which you would think are unnecessary if you're not, as an actor, speaking words. And of course, as an actor, you can tell the audience all this story. You can't if you're not using words. Those things are very, very important to me, and they're very important to my dancers. Because when they go on stage, they truly think as actors think. They feel about their character as a well-rounded person. They know about their history and their future. Mm-hmm. They can take an attitude towards it. Some would regard it as an unnecessary indulgence. I don't, and I don't think our dancers do. They know that to convince an audience that they are who they say they are in the story, they need to believe that person. And every second on stage for them is accounted for. There are no moments when you see somebody standing at the back holding the proverbial spear. Hmm. We just don't have that. Everybody is part of the story.
So it goes back to that love of theater and that theater that your mom and dad did.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And it's always been, I mean, people have asked me, what are the things you would like to do? I'd love to continue directing, but directing straight plays, directing more musicals. I'd love to make a film. Things where I feel that I could really just develop those skills. Because as a choreographer, I've always felt pretty inadequate as a choreographer. I'm at my most vulnerable when I'm in a studio trying to create steps. And that's largely because I'm thinking, what are the steps trying to say? We're having a conversation. I'm trying to make steps that tell the conversation, and I'm trying to get the opposite person to respond in movement as if it was a real dialogue. I struggle a lot with the idea, let's just do some great steps and nobody will know what we're really saying together. So the classic for me is in Romeo and Juliet, when you have two young lovers, you know, teenagers falling in love, and the idea that they would spend a lot of time just dancing with their back to each other or running away from each other. They wouldn't. They'd be on top of each other and fumbling and being very inadequate, but they would be enthusiastic and youthful. So when I created Romeo and Juliet, I just wanted that to be the most important thing, that people would come out and feel breathless and youthful and excited. And that happens. And so your dancers have to break huge barriers, because you're asking them to be completely real. Mm-hmm. So when they touch and they kiss, it's real. It's not. There's not a distance. Mirror, Mirror, when we created Mirror, Mirror, we were hoping to make production that looked very contemporary and very stylized and would really be very powerful. I was asking my boys to wear these strange masks and dance in with very little vision, but to be a part of this great seething mass of bodies. These guys just get up and go, yep, we got it. And you can see, you just see the level of creativity that just makes you go, this is so wonderful. Mm-hmm. Because you talk about time. When I'm creating these major productions, which are usually, you know, getting on for two and a half hours long, that we have 5 weeks of rehearsal. So let's break that down. That's 5 weeks of rehearsal, only five days in a work week. And we have contractually 6 hours a day in which we can create that. Well, you know, the volume of what we do and the amount of people that are on stage, and by the time we add children from our school into the production and we've got the design and so it's
a huge production.
I'm surprised sometimes I'm not in that funny farm loony bin place, because it puts me through an incredible amount of stress. But the way I do that is that everything is written down. So when I talked about making a movie or something, my scripts and synopsis for these productions are very detailed. Some will go on to 30, 40 pages long. And the reason I do that is that I can make all my choices about how I'm going to tell these stories. I can debate them with my creative team and the composer and everybody else, and we can spend weeks and years and months doing all this. And then when we come to it, it's there. It's the script. So I can flip the page and say, okay, I'm going to deal with this scene now, and then I can go back to this scene here. And as long as I stay to it, to the script, it should come out. And touch wood, it always has. So that's another thing, which I think is very unusual in the dance world. Because, again, people get in there, they start choreographing, dancing. I'm loving the way this feels. Let's do more of this. Let's have a little bit more of that. And I'm far more disciplined about saying, no, this is it. It fits in this bit of music, and it goes here, and this goes here, and that person goes here, and this happens. And so it all comes together. It's the only way I know how to deliver And I think if I were to try any other way of working, I wouldn't probably achieve much. I would get lost.
So you do all this incredible preparation, and it's such a show with all the costumes and the lighting and the music and the live music and sometimes original scores, and it's a massive effort. And you're only on stage this short number of performances. I always think, how can you put all this effort in? Why don't you have longer runs? Why is that?
It's the most soul-destroying part of this job. There is a moment, because everybody builds up to that first night, it's so exciting, and I secretly, inside of me, I kind of take a step back because I just know we're going to open and close in one weekend, which is hideous when you think about everything. I mean, I think of, you know, Ella Enchanted that opened last Friday, first stage, it's going to run for a month. And I think of The Rep that did, you know, American Song, another world premiere, which is phenomenal.
Yes,
and if you haven't seen it, guys, go see it,
absolutely.
It is life-changing. Mm-hmm. I just saw Invisible Hand as well. You know, these things, they sit down and they do a month of performances, 3 weeks of performances. The reason why doesn't the ballet do that, you may ask? Well, availability space in the PAC. So the PAC is, you know, as you know, is a very popular place. It's got Broadway, it's got the symphony in there, it's got the opera in there, it's got a lot of things. So the availability of space, cost is always a consideration. A lot of our productions have live orchestra with it. The Milwaukee Ballet Orchestra, that's a cost implication. The opera and the ballet and the symphony are the three fine arts that in any culture around the world, you accept the fact that by the nature of these art forms, they are intrinsically very expensive, but they are the fine arts, and that you make a decision as a community to want an opera and a symphony and a ballet for the value of what they bring to your community. And anybody who loves anyone, if not all three of those art forms, will absolutely stand by it and say there is nothing. When done well, there really is nothing better within those art forms. So, but the point is that they come with a high price tag. So you make your commitment to support a good symphony, a good opera and a ballet, and then the community grows from there. And it influences so many other aspects of art and the education that those three organizations can do within the community. So what I'm saying is that if the community were really to support even more those three major institutions, and I would even advocate that the three come together almost like we do in Europe, where we have an opera house, and the opera house is your opera, your symphony, and your ballet, and it's run by a management, and the PAC could be such a place. It would allow you to be able to do more and rotate more. So we create these major productions where we could do them one weekend, and then we could come back and do them three weekends later. Mm-hmm. You know, you can mix and match.
Good idea.
So there are lots of ways in which we could do it. Let's see, you know, let's see what happens in the future. I think there's an argument that we don't have an audience for that. I don't believe that. What we do have is America's filled with way too larger theaters. That was bad English, but way too many theaters that are too large. When you're trying to fill a theater with 2,200 seats or even 3,000 or 4,000, then people just think, okay, you can only do two or three shows. Well, the reality is, you know, 4,000 people on one night in a theater is an extreme, you know, unless it's a pop show or something.
Right.
So I think if we keep our expectations in line with what our community can observe, and again, as we're growing and more people are coming to the city, I'm hoping there's going to be more demand. Who knows the availability of the space and the funding, which is why it's important people give to you, the United Performing Arts Fund. I mean, they're the ones that are helping us directly. But I will say, I mean, the cost of all our arts is a great value to our city, as you know, and you know, everybody knows.
Completely. Yeah. So are talks underway to look at that possibility of using the PAC?
Well, I think some of it depends. Some of it depends on the future of the PAC, and the symphony has long wanted its own venue, which I would think is a great thing. Every city should have a great concert hall. Now we know that's always been a talk. Again, Milwaukee talk. It could happen tomorrow. Who knows? I don't know. But it could, if that would free space up in the theater, would that change our relationship with the theater? It would certainly would, and I would be a part of making sure that we would discuss that. So there's lots of potential for what moves forward. And again, if we, as a community, if we develop a cultural plan for improving our city, maybe that would be a part of the discussion, is how do we want to balance our art? What should we have? Because you have to make choices as a choreographer, as a director, on the people you choose to work with, the type of productions, how long they are, how long sections are, all of these things. You also have to make a choice as a community about how much art will you fund? When is too much and when is not enough? And how do we make those decisions? They're not easy ones to make, but they're responsible ones.
We fund our sports, don't we?
We do indeed. Yeah.
And then some. Would you like to direct Romeo and Juliet on stage sometimes?
Gosh, I think it would be great. I would be wildly intimidated by the language. I mean, the whole Shakespearean language is a world apart. I have such admiration for people. John McClay at First Stage, you know, he lives and breathes Shakespeare. And when I hear John talk about that and watch him work with it, you realize that it's just a world you would need to discover. But again, from an education standpoint, I would immerse myself in any opportunity 100%. Just to experience that. Mm-hmm. Because we're all, as creative artists, we're all fundamentally very vulnerable and very flawed. We may profess to be very confident. We may speak very well. But deep down inside us, we're all emotionally very vulnerable, which is why we produce the kind of work we do. Mm.
Michael Pink is our guest this hour. He's the artistic director of the Milwaukee Ballet. There's been so much to talk about, and I have 10 questions for what he's already said. But we will talk about next season, what the ballet will be performing next year, the 2016-17 season. It has just recently been announced, so we'll talk about that. And welcome phone calls. This may be a kind of conversation you just want to listen to, but his idea is an interesting one. Maybe this is a starting point of turning the PAC in the city of Milwaukee, where we are, into a place where the symphony performs the opera and the ballet, and that's what it's for. Or does it need the ballet its own building? Should the symphony have its own building? Why is it that we can support some endeavors in this area, mainly sports endeavors, but we have this wonderful, we have great ballet, terrific theater, a wonderful symphony. It's just such an important part of this city, probably as important as having Lake Michigan over to our east, which makes the city. But the arts are extraordinary in this city, and they get you, and they get you living here and keep you living here and change the quality of your life. So what can we do to allow the ballet to perform more often? Well, join us if you'd like. Just the invitation. It's out there, 800-486-8655. We have some emails that have come in. We'll go to those and welcome your calls. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, we have emails coming in, but if you want to join us by phone, feel free to do so, 800-486-8655. This is from Thomas. What a great asset to our city Michael Pink is. The work he has come up with, visually stunning, and they bring classic ballet into our modern times. This person has seen all of the performances this season and last. They were breathtaking, Thomas says. It allows me to work with Michael and his visual creatives, because he does the studio photography for this season. And all the people have so much respect for you. And so he says thank you very much.
Thank you, Thomas. And if you've seen this, the next season brochure, the photography.
Yes, let's talk about it.
My gosh, it's quite stunning. We should tell you that, yeah, Thomas uses his fabulous studio RDI image. They take amazing photographs. He does. He's a great artist. But the actual composition of the pictures is actually designed really by two dancers, Tim O'Donnell and Rachel Mailhorn. And that's another thing that I think is really very, very important. We talk about the fact that a dancer's life as a professional dancer is relatively short, so one should always be thinking about the next step.
Right.
And that's why we encourage people to continue with academic studies. We've got, at the end of this season, we're going to have one or two artists moving off, retiring, leaving, and all of them have really taken heed to those words of wisdom, and they've invested their time and their downtime in further education. So they're preparing for the next step of their life. So Tim and Rachel, who are very interested in all of this artwork, are already exploring those ideas. And I love the idea of my dancers being involved in so much more than just what they do on stage, because they understand it, they appreciate it more, and they bring a wealth of emotion and understanding to the marketing department, the development department, that unless you've done this job, you couldn't possibly have it. So it's a perfect match. So next year we're going to begin, as a lot of people know, we do 5 separate shows. And as you said, we work very hard for so few performances. But we begin the year with the return of Scheherazade, which is Rimsky-Korsakov's just fabulous music, lots of solo violin, perfect for Milwaukee Ballet Orchestra. And this is a production that was commissioned early on when I came here. And it's going to be wonderful to see it come back. The production is also paired with the return of the Angels in the Architecture, which is the music of Copland, and it's Mark Godden, a Canadian choreographer. He's going to return to create this piece. So that's what we call a double bill. So when you buy your ticket, you get two for the price.
All right.
We love that. Then we go off to our wonderful Nutcracker, which I have to tell you, Nutcracker is now... My gosh, this production is getting to be quite old. So what I'm really looking for, Catherine, is the next person out there who wants their name on top of a new Nutcracker that will be with us for the next 15 years. I can just see it now. Your name above the Nutcracker, the annual Nutcracker. It's just going to cost you a cool million and a bit of change. So if there's any major corporations out there that want that and they want to make their mark in the city, here we go. Anyhow, moving on from there, we have the Genesis... The Genesis Choreographic Competition, which is the one...
I love it.
And we invite three competitors from around the world to come in and create a work, and we will bring in a panel of esteemed judges. And the winner, it's not a monetary thing more than an exposure thing. So the winner will return the following year and will create another original work on our company. So we're helping to promote new work. We're also building strong relations with the hopefully the future choreographers. Genesis, following Genesis... We're going to bring to town a beautiful romantic ballet. So all the people out there that know a lot about dance will know when I say La Sylphide, not Le Sylphide. La Sylphide is a two-act ballet, a beautiful story about a sylph who visits a young Scottish man in the Highlands, and so the guys are all wearing kilts, and he falls madly in love with her. And the problem is when you fall in love with a sylph, it usually doesn't turn out very well. So guys out there, be warned. Anyhow, so that's a stunning ballet, and I'm so excited about that one because there is a wonderful lady called Dina Bjorn, whom I've worked with a lot in Norway, and she has a direct line, a lineage to almost to the original Bournonville family. Bournonville was the original creator of this work and was one of the great dance makers in history, and her father was really an extraordinary man who looked after the heritage of this work. So I feel like we're getting first-hand guidance. So our dancers are going to be exposed to working with this extraordinary lady, La Sylphide, and that also will be a twofer because we're going to be Tim O'Donnell, who is one of the designers of this beautiful program, is also an extraordinary choreographer and winner of one of the Genesis competitions.
So
you're beginning to piece it all together.
Nice.
And so Tim will be creating probably his seventh new work for the company and the school, which will pair with that one. And we're going to end with the return of Mirror Mirror. Mirror Mirror we did 2 years ago. And because I explained to you we have so little time when we're creating these great works, I always say to myself, the caveat is we opened it, we got it on stage, the audience loved it, now it needs finishing. And every time I look at the video and the rehearsal videos, I go, I'm going to make copious notes of what needs to be finished, what needs to be changed, what needs to be developed. So we're giving ourselves the opportunity to bring that back, develop it, and finish it. And of course, we'll have one or two new faces in the company who will be taking prominent roles within that production. And again, my ideal is at the end of creating some of these major works is that I can send them around the country to other companies and say, here, look, we have this. Milwaukee made this. Would you like to rent it from us? And if they do, that becomes a little bit of revenue for the company.
Nice.
So it really pays to have these assets of new productions, which is why we started a New Works Fund this year as well. I asked Sue and Bud Selig, you know, I mean, he's a great supporter of the arts, of course. And he and Sue agreed that they would make a donation to the company and we would use it as a New Works Fund. So everybody who gives to the New Works Fund, they will match that contribution. And we'll put that into a pot and we will use it just for new work. And the new work will be for the main company, it will be for our second company, and it could even be new work for our school because we have a large school of over 600 kids.
Do you really?
Yeah.
600 kids. And the second company is very, very good. They're wonderful.
The second company is 20 dancers, and they too come from all around the world. We're accredited by the National Associations for the Schools of Dance, which means that a governing body has decided that this organization meets the criteria by which we will be able to... we'll be able to apply for study visas, M1 study visas, which means that young dancers can come from anywhere in the world and spend time with us. And our second company really is our outreach company. So they go out and they do all of the community activity. They also do their own performances. And without them, we would not be able to put so many bodies on stage for the Nutcracker, for Mirror Mirror. So they get the most amazing experience about what it will be like to become a professional dancer. And the good side of this is that if there are any vacancies in the company and we have good, strong dancers in that second company,
right.
I'm feeding in from people who understand us. So it's a good philosophy for really building the identity of the company. And really over 40% of our company has come through that program and has stayed with us.
Excellent. We had somebody who couldn't stay on the line. Wanted you to mention the program you have that matches dancers with special needs children and how important that is for community building.
Yeah, the Tour de Force program is something that we started last year, and it really is working with the Children's Hospital in Freidat. And it's taking each child who has very special needs, each day part of their regime is stretching and keeping their bodies moving. And so we're working with one child, one therapist and one of our company dancers or our second company dancers, and they work one-on-one with these little tots, and they do their stretching and their movements. And of course, it means for those little kids that otherwise this is just a daily routine, they have a new face, a new body, new relationship, and they have dancers there in their dance gear, and then the dancers will get up and show them movements, so they get the joy of that. And then wherever possible, and we'd love to do this more and more, we bring those little kids and their families into the performance, so they now feel they have a relationship with the dancer, they get to see the ballet. It's magical. For these children. The program started as a very small program, it's now grown, and we have an extensive waiting list to make that happen. So again, any funders out there who feel that ticks all their boxes, get in touch with us, because we're always looking for ways in which we can bring more people in to do more, which is, again, the ballet is the performances you see on stage and that people talk about and that people love, that's the top of the pyramid. When you go down, you have the second company, the school, it expands. All of this outreach work, we touch the community on a daily basis through our outreach work, as so many other arts organizations do. And there really are no limits to what we can do other than the restrictions of money and people and time. Well, we can continue to grow that. And if we can move into a new facility with a little bit more space, we'll be able to continue to invest in the community, and that will lead to greater education, greater understanding, yes, of the art form, greater audience. It's all about building our audience for all of our arts.
Yeah. Do you feel like the audience is building, Michael?
I do. And I think in our recent performance at the Pabst Theatre, we did an adaptation of Oscar Wilde's Dorian Gray, a picture of Dorian Gray, in which I had an actor on stage speaking words, being part of the production in costume, the whole thing. We had a small orchestra of a very relatively contemporary score, etc. And I was secretly, standing by for those one or two complaints about somebody talking on stage, contemporary music, and so on and so forth, and why. And I didn't receive one. Not one bad press. So I was very pleased with the fact that I saw many, many familiar faces there of all ages and a lot of new faces. And to a man, they believed what they saw on stage. They were impressed, so much so that they went along for the ride. That says a huge amount about our audience,
yes,
because you know as well as I do, 10 years ago, that wouldn't have been the case.
Right.
So we have moved together, and that's a powerful thing.
It is. Well, I think you're terrific, and I love the ballet, and I told you I wanted to go last Thursday, but I've seen so many of the productions, and I haven't seen a bad one. Just haven't seen a bad one. So, well, you better come back before 2 years from now.
I better do, yes, yeah. We should make this an annual date.
All right, let's do it.
Yeah, let's do that. And then maybe somebody will phone in. I mean,
people phoned in, but we were so involved in talking that we couldn't.
Oh,
I should have interrupted you. But
No, that's good.
Fine. It's good. It's good to be able to just talk sometimes.
Yeah, well, thank you if you did phone in. And, you can always reach out to the ballet. And if you did have a question, we'll gladly email back to you if you email us at the ballet. So,
at the ballet.
At the ballet.
At the ballet.
Everything is beautiful. Okay, sorry.
Oh, yeah, we should have asked you to sing, but we don't have time now. Michael Pink, our guest.
I'll sing us out. I'll auto fade out.
Thank you. I like it. Company's artistic director, and we thank him so much. What a life he's had. It's just wonderful. Well, thanks very much to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP as well for on air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Just a reminder that today is primary election day. If you're listening to us, you certainly know that is the case. Tonight there will be election analysis and results coming in. 8 o'clock is when our coverage will start. So if you want to watch television and listen to the radio, or if you're driving somewhere, we really do very good election coverage. If you haven't discovered us, please discover us tonight at 8 o'clock. We're with you tomorrow at 1 o'clock when we will analyze, as will many other programs, analyze what happened today in Wisconsin. Thanks to Michael Pink, our Artistic Director of the Milwaukee Ballet, for being with us. Thanks for listening. News is coming out from National Public Radio, and great conversations ahead.